The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Angela Scanlon, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brendan. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. And so, Angela, we know you as a broadcaster, but you're an author now as well. You've written a book, Joyrider, and I suppose it's kind of part memoir and part helpful advice about life and that. It might surprise people because people might imagine you as a very up, very confident kind of person who has it all together and everything. But not the case, because you say in this book you've basically lived for many years split in two. You spent 37 years trying to be someone else. Can you explain that?
How long do we have, Brendan? Yeah, I suppose I kind of did feel very, very split. I am quite positive and upbeat, and certainly that was maybe heightened, you know, there was a slightly heightened version of that I felt was expected when I started doing telly and all of that kind of stuff. But I definitely think there was a disconnect with how I felt at home, really, and inside. And there was a kind of sense that nobody really wanted to hear that. And, you know, many people may feel it's a first world problems thing and we don't need to hear more people talking about their struggles. But I think it's really important, actually, to kind of acknowledge all of those aspects of ourselves, I suppose. And what I don't want to do, or what I certainly didn't want to do, was do a book that's kind of built around the idea of toxic positivity, which I think there's a lot of, and just papering over the cracks. So there is a lot of it of me in that, but I think the kind of the joy, I guess, that I write about has been quite hard earned, I suppose. Yeah, and only really when I got stuck into the slightly darker stuff did I begin to access that.
And because you've had a hugely successful career presenting big shows in the UK, like the One Show, you even have, as you point out, you have the hair ad, like the Vina McCall life and everything. But the sense is that none of this gave you the validation that you were after.
Exactly that. And look, I don't think it's a surprise that I ended up in the public eye. There was a kind of sense that maybe I was seeking that validation from more and more and more people. And, you know, even if I got it, it didn't really do very much to fill me up, I suppose. So I started, and we spoke about this or touched on it the last time that we spoke. I think it was in the middle of lockdown, and it was that kind of sense that I was always striving and pushing to the next thing, and there was no enjoyment really in the doing of the thing. It was like getting the gig and then on to the next. And I think a lot of people will probably relate, you know, regardless of what area you work in or whether work is that focus, but that idea of looking on to the next thing and never quite appreciating where you are in the moment. And I think gratitude can sometimes be received, it feels a bit fluffy or a bit new age, but actually, you know, from a science point of view, there's so much to kind of support and back up the massive benefits that it has in kind of shifting your perspective and stopping with that dreaded comparison, which I think we all kind of suffer with to a greater or lesser degree, more so now than ever because of social media, you know. So it's kind of the work for me was looking at what I have and appreciating what I have, you know, before it's gone, while I'm still doing it, instead of looking around at other people and feeling like I'm consistently falling short.
And it's probably a particularly difficult in the business you're in and over there and everything. I presume there is always that pressure to be getting ahead, and that anyone else's success in a way can make you die a little bit inside, can it?
Well, the thing is that's, you know, I think we're kind of made to believe that, and that there's not enough to go around, and maybe more so as a woman, there's one seat at the table. So if there's one there already, I do think society kind of feeds that a little bit. But actually, it did affect my experience of like enjoying the things that I had, because it was like, oh no, somebody else has done something bigger or better or whatever else. But I think that's kind of, it's a bit of a hollow place to be, always looking around at other people, you know. So I mean, I have to still work at it. Yeah. And that's the thing, the book. I mean, I am not a guru or an expert. It's very much from my own kind of personal experience. And I've tried lots of different stuff over the years. So it's the kind of things in my little toolkit that I consistently come back to, you know?
Absolutely. Of course, it didn't take show business to kind of make you like this, because the picture you paint from when you were a kid, really, you were always kind of on, weren't you? Always creating versions of yourself, you say.
Yes. Yeah, I think I was. And I, you know, I wasn't aware of that, obviously, at the time. And it took me a long time to kind of look back and recognize that that's what I was doing. And it was, I suppose it was people pleasing, really, for want of a better term. And it was kind of that idea that I had to be a different version. And I'd kind of, again, really like unconsciously arrive in a situation and kind of assess very quickly who they expected me to be or who they wanted me to be or what would go down well. And I kind of, you know, delivered that. And again, that maybe heightened that kind of sense of disconnect. I was like, I don't really know, you know, who I am. And that was probably heightened then when I had a baby, because it was, you know, that struggle with identity after you become a mother, especially when a lot of your identity is tied up in work and what you do. So I think, yeah, there was definitely a struggle with really understanding who I was, actually, and what I was into and what I was about, because I was kind of, you know, switching it out depending on the audience, big or small.
Exhausting.
Yeah.
The book is very honest. You say in the book that you had an eating disorder for, I think, 15 years. Was that connected with that sense of yourself as well?
I think it's all connected, really. And I suppose, you know, there's kind of a question, and it was certainly something that I grappled with, whether I would include something like that, because you can't put it back in the box. And it is deeply personal, I suppose. And so, for me, it was kind of this sense of it was for a very long time, so much shame around that. And it's a kind of very hidden thing. And there aren't many people out there talking about it. And I think thankfully we have people talking about anxiety and talking about depression and mental health more generally. But my experience when I was a kid was, you know, Karen Carpenter, who had a pretty tragic ending, and then Jerry Halliwell, you know, if you were a 90s girl, you know, was kind of the poster girl for that. And there was a certain amount of ridicule and kind of eye rolling around that, which probably made me very keen to keep it under wraps. And I suppose growing up, or when I was a teenager, or when I was in my 20s, or when I was in the thick of dealing with my eating disorder, and you know, it's an addiction. I think it's quite difficult for people to understand, and it comes in many different forms, but it can be a very kind of lonely, very isolated place to exist in. And I think that, you know, it's better to keep that silent. It's not a nice thing to talk about. It's uncomfortable. It makes other people uncomfortable. Nobody knows really what to do. And so I did stay quiet about it for a long time. And
Who knew about it at the time, Angela?
Initially, nobody. And, you know, there were points when I realized that I needed help that I kind of reached out, and then I would retreat and go, actually, maybe I don't need help. This is kind of feels safer to have this around me, something that I can kind of control when everything else felt out of control. And look, that's not to say there was anything dramatic, you know, in a trauma sense that happened to me. There is no event that kind of spurred all of this on. I think it was just kind of came from a deep sensitivity in me, and who knows. But yeah, my parents knew, and they helped at the time. But I think, like with anyone, and you know, unless you're really open and willing and ready to get help, I think it's kind of pointless, and nobody can really do anything for you. So I do talk about how I kind of essentially switched that out for a focus on work, which was, you know, arguably more socially acceptable. It was more lucrative and, yeah, had a lot more upside, let's say, but still, you know, something that had to be dealt with in the long term and that I still have to deal with.
Yeah. Living with an eating disorder for 15 years is no joke. Yeah. Like just to give people a sense of how you were living, tell me about when you were in America and you were a competitive Irish dancer touring in America.
Yeah. So here's the thing. And I think sometimes there can be a fixation on, now tell me, how much were you eating or not eating? And there's a kind of like a fixation on that. And I think that can be like triggering if somebody's listening and experiencing that. But it also kind of, you know, it's so personal to everybody that I don't even know that it's helpful, I suppose, to talk about what I was doing in terms of restriction. But I was very, you know, it was absolute minimum. And I think it's more, to my mind, and the reason that I shared it is to kind of try and create awareness, because I think a lot of the time, and I mean, this is more recently with friends of mine who wouldn't have known about my eating disorder, who would say, oh my God, like roll their eyes. It's an annoyance because people's experience of sharing a meal is affected when somebody sitting across the table is not eating the way they want them to eat. And we, you know, we kind of probably have all experienced that. You're like, oh my God, I wanted a pizza today and she was eating a salad. And, it, you know, it causes annoyance, and it misses the point and the complexities around eating disorders as, you know, a psychological kind of
illness
when the fixation is on how many calories. So I kind of
I wasn't asking for you to parade your details. I asked you because I thought it was quite a shocking kind of just a kind of a reality check on what living with an eating disorder is like. But I completely take where you're coming from. You shared it in the book, but you don't want to talk about it here on air. I got you. I see your point, though. I absolutely do. When you talk about that complexity of it, and you mentioned the idea that it came from possibly a sensitivity within you that it's an addiction. Do you understand the why of it now? Or are there easy whys?
I don't think there are. I mean, like, and I talk about this, the idea that I was very keen on being fixed. Like, I genuinely wanted to try all the potions, anything, like throw me whatever you have. And this kind of sense that I was striving to be like fixed, to kind of fill myself, I suppose, is the only way I can articulate it. And I don't think there is a why. You know, which sometimes can be really, really frustrating and a bit kind of disconcerting that, you know, if there was an event that you can stem things back to and kind of hang things on that can maybe offer some sort of comfort as to why that behavior is there. Whereas if there's nothing identifiable and you've had, you know, a really lovely upbringing and you've had like everything you've ever needed, then to feel the way I felt was very confusing and felt like I was, you know, ungrateful, or I was kind of just a bit defective. I think, you know, I had all of the things that anyone would ever need. So why did I feel like this without being able to articulate or identify any one thing was, hard. So the answer is I haven't a clue.
and then, as you say, kind of tongue in cheek, you kind of cured yourself in a manner
very
of speaking.
Tongue-in-cheek.
Tell me about the cure then.
Yeah, well, it was that sense of swapping out. You know, I was kind of like, okay, I need to get myself together here. And I had a kind of dramatic breakup after a long on and off again relationship. And suddenly the realization that I was going to have to build a kind of life for myself. And so I just became extremely fixated on work, you know, and like I say, much more socially acceptable form of addiction. And a lot of people now probably more than ever can relate to that, and this kind of hustle culture and everyone having a side gig and this, you know, just relentless kind of production, which I think is, you know, equally unhealthy and also doesn't get to the root of it either, you know. So I've kind of had to work a lot on that, you know. And there are like lots of tips and things that I've kind of come across over the years and things that I come back to. And gratitude, like I say, can sometimes kind of feel like one of those things that is a bit fluffy. And if you're in a hole or you're struggling with addiction or just in a dark place, that can feel quite out of reach. And joy can certainly feel out of reach. So it's kind of just that sense of flexing that muscle of understanding more than anything that all of these states, whether you're in the depths or whether you're high as a kite, they're all fleeting. And sometimes when you're in that, it's very hard to see that you'll come out the other side, you know. So it's.
So look, that busyness that you became addicted to did bring you huge success and everything.
Yeah.
But I suppose I get this kind of sense of somebody who's dancing as fast as you could. And then on February 2018, You had your daughter Ruby, and you stopped.
Yes. Yeah.
And what happened then?
I just kind of, I had no idea who I was if I wasn't working, if I wasn't out there busy pitching, doing the job, doing any job, you know. And I was really lucky in that all of that came. And like I say, there was a lot of upside, and you know, that kind of level of drive, and I still have that, but it comes from a different place now, I think, which is healthier rather than just aimless distraction, which is where I was at the time, you know, having to sit still and grappling with who I was when I wasn't working was a massive shock to the system. And you know, ultimately was brilliant, you know, the things that I kind of didn't give myself I felt compelled to do for my daughter, because I thought this is not right. Whatever I'm feeling here can't be it. And so it was at that point that, although, you know, I had kind of talked about getting help and I had been offered it in the past, I never went for it really. I certainly didn't commit to it. It was like, okay, no, I really, really want to change the way I live now, because this is not sustainable. And surely this most, you know, wonderful kind of event in your life, becoming a mother for the first time, should be bringing me joy. And again, I'm not saying, I think there's an Instagram version of that, and there's the reality of, you know, sleepless nights and not knowing who you are. But for me, it was that kind of like catalyst to go, okay, it's time now I start digging around and figuring out why I'm so uneasy in my own skin, truthfully. And so there is a lot in the book about that kind of idea of self-knowledge and really getting to know yourself and sitting with yourself, which I think is deeply uncomfortable for a lot of us.
You? And what did you find out?
I guess I found out all of the things. You know, I kind of got to grips with bits of myself that I was less comfortable with, but had kind of shut down, which allowed me then to get to grips with myself, the bits, you know, bits of me that I like. And I think that was the thing. I really didn't like myself very much,
really,
for a long time. So I think, you know, as you say, dancing and keeping myself busy allowed me to not have to really look at that and look at myself. So yeah, it's scary and it's not very pleasant at times, but I am really glad that I've done it, you know. And so yeah, I'm not the finished article but I think that's also part of the realization and the kind of acceptance that it's a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah, and you know when you'll be the finished article, like that'll be right at the end. So
when I'm in a box.
Yeah. Story will be finally finished then. Listen.
Yeah, exactly.
So the book is full then, as you say, of various spiritual, practical kind of tips, lessons you've learned and everything. And look, I'm conscious, as you say, you're not an expert or presenting yourself as one, but you're a person who's learned a lot of lessons. So what was the most useful thing you learned, do you think, for people?
Oh, I mean, I actually think it is touching on that, and it's useful. I mean, is literally sitting in that. First of all, that's the key to it. And then I think it's knowing that you can shift out of a mood, that you can change your perception. And I think that's where the gratitude thing comes in. It's that it's kind of flexing that muscle like you would in the gym, though that's not my particular form of exercise. But like, yeah, that you can kind of decide in any moment how you want to receive something. So if, you know, something goes wrong in a day, you can either let it take you out and you can kind of drown under the weight of it, or you can shift your perspective and your perception and focus on the things that are good rather than the stuff that has gone wrong. And like I said, I mean, I started my podcast because I was not very good at sticking with those consistent things day in, day out that I kind of knew were good for me. But I thought, oh, yeah, no, work, I'm good at that. I will show up to that. So I, you know, Thanks a Million was kind of born out of that. But it is the consistent things that feel a bit boring and feel a bit square. But, you know, every day practicing those things and being a bit compassionate with yourself, you know, not in the Instagram self-care sense of a petal bath and a face mask, although, you know, fill your boots, but more so in just like every day giving yourself a break, having a nap if you can.
Yeah, yeah.
And just allowing yourself to be a bit human and messy and gross and fabulous all at once.
And how are you now? Do you go easy on yourself?
I do. I try to. I mean, you know, there's I need to kind of keep myself in check. And I think that's all of us. There are patterns and there are behaviors that I've spent, you know, nearly 40 years perfecting. So it's going to take some time to unravel those. But I think it's being kind of aware and giving myself a little moment to pause and go, okay, hang on now. Who is this chatting to me? The voices in my head. Is it one I want to listen to today, or can we shut her down? So yeah, I'm good actually. A little nervous about all of this, and you know, feel quite exposed.
I was going to ask you.
Yeah, you can. I mean, like you sit and you write something, and I think I forget. It's like when I do telly, I kind of forget that people will watch it if you're lucky. So I did it and I poured my heart and soul into it. And there is a lot of kind of, yeah, there's a lot of me in there and parts of me that I certainly have never talked about openly before. But that was important to me as well, was to kind of show the whole spectrum, not just the shiny telly version.
Yeah, but look, I suppose, isn't it part of the work too, to think that if you've done something useful, that's a good thing too, isn't it? So
absolutely.
The book is called Joyrider by Angela Scanlon. It's published by Vermilion and it's out now. Angela Scanlon, thank you so much, and thank you for being so honest and open today.
Thanks so much, Brendan. You always dig around in the deepest places. I should have been warned.
It was all in the book. Stop.
No, I know.
I didn't
know.
Do
I
that to you.
I need to mentally prepare myself for Brendan O'Connor. He doesn't beat around the bush.
You sound like you were very well mentally prepared today. And listen, good luck. What's next for you, Angela?
Thank you. What is now? I mean, I'm taking some time. I have a small baby. This baby, the book baby, is a little pointier, but my other baby is downstairs and in need of a feed. And I'm gonna, once I've done the rounds and met a few people around the book, then I'm going back into hiding and taking a little bit of time out. So that's my plan.
Good for you. Enjoy that, Angela Scanlon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And if you were affected by any of the issues that Angela was discussing there, you can go to rte.ie/helplines to find out where there is somebody you could talk to. Or indeed, BodyWise, the Eating Disorders Association of Ireland, their national helpline is 01-210-7906, or email alex@bodywise.ie, and that's BODYWHYS.ie.